paid into Medicare for decades. Don't spend retirement limping. The Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. It's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000.
WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to do on the program today. We're going to start things off with Susan Burfield, a writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote about how, perhaps improbably, Best Buy seems to be surviving, perhaps even thriving, in the age of Amazon, when so many other retailers are really struggling, unable to scale and compete in the way that Amazon does. Susan, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And so talk us through the story, because it, indeed, that brand is still out there and seems to be holding strong. So how is Best Buy able to do this when Amazon seems to just have so much strength to topple so many other retailers?
Yeah. So, Best Buy, I think, looked at its advantages. And basically, that means, what does it have that Amazon doesn't? So it has stores and it has staff. People, right? So it figured if it could make its stores, a fun, interesting place to be, if it could make its staff very helpful, that there would still be interest in coming into a store and kind of, touching, trying out electronics and looking at, the various appliances that they sell. And the key to all of that was that letting people know that they would get as good a price at Best Buy as they would if they bought on Amazon. So the first thing the CEO did when he came was to say that he was going to have Best Buy match the price that Amazon offered. So right away, that took away a big advantage from Amazon, right? And then the second thing he's done over the years is turn Amazon, into kind of a would-be vanquisher, into a sometime partner. That has started with having Amazon sell some of its products in the stores, along with other tech companies. Samsung, Apple all have kind of their own spot in Best Buy. And then more recently, Best Buy and Amazon announced that they're going to be selling an exclusive TV together. So that's something that, is a bit of a risk for Best Buy, but they want Amazon to be a partner and to consider itself a partner, not a rival.
And then enter Geek Squad into this. And that there's been kind of a, there's a brand that's been around a while also, mm-hmm. but there's been a shift there too culturally.
Yeah. So, Geek Squad, as maybe people know, will come to your home and repair gadgets and, install appliances that you buy from Best Buy. They over the years, like everything else at Best Buy, kind of suffered from the lack of attention and investment. So that was something else that Jolie spent some time and money on early on in his tenure. He's been there for 6 years now. More recently, what he has started and what we focused on in our stories for Bloomberg Businessweek is a new program that they call In-Home Advisors. And basically, it's a group of people who get special training, 5 weeks worth, and they will come to your home and kind of serve as a consultant, look around, widely through your house at what you might need in terms of technology. And so the battle overall, I think, it used to be for kind of people's attention on their phones. And now the next, kind of frontier, if you will, is in the home itself.
And how was that culture shift able to be, navigated? That seems like a big change to go from kind of a salesperson to kind of consultant. And it seemed to be that it used to, Geek Squad would match the worker to the task, and there are experts in computers and experts in this appliance and this appliance. But then it seemed like this is more of a shift where the person dispatched has to be kind of a consultant to a lot of different technology now.
Yeah. I mean, it's fraught, right? Because you have to have people who know a lot about a lot, and you know, Best Buy's response to that is that's why we give them 5 weeks of intensive training. But beyond that, you know, it's one thing for a customer to go into a store. You know, they can end the interaction whenever they want. They can leave. If you have someone in your home, that's a little more complicated. And so part of the training and what we observed was, you know, teaching these people how to behave in a home, how to sell in a home without seeming to sell. So, you know, you're saying these aren't supposed to be kind of one-time transactions where a geek squad or a salesperson in the store just wants to, like, do what they're there to do for, make the deal, you know, close, move on. These in-home advisors are supposed to kind of develop relationships with what they're now calling clients. Supposed to be long-term and, you know, Jolie, the CEO, came from McKinsey, and so he's viewing them really as consultants, like building a long-term relationship with clients.
Well, it will be interesting to see how this continues. Susan Burfield, writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, thanks so much for being with us. For those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and tweet this story out after the program so you can read it for yourself, including some of the really interesting details about this training that Susan's describing. Susan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about the Disney-Fox merger. In particular, it's of note because Comcast has changed direction a bit on it. So more on that when we return here on 720 WGN. WGN. Welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Glad to be with you today. Thanks for sharing part of your Saturday with us here. We're joined now by Steven Zajcik, who is an entertainment business writer at Washington Post, who wrote about this looming Disney-Fox merger. It has been in the news a while. It's kind of one of those big behemoth stories that's kind of difficult to follow. But lately, the new detail is that Comcast has officially dropped its pursuit of 21st Century Fox. So this has kind of changed the game a little bit. Steven, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Great to be here, Amy.
So talk us through this, because in particular, it kind of immediately makes us wonder, you know, well, what will the landscape look like once all of this kind of shakes out? There's a lot of possibilities kind of staring at us here.
It really is, and you're right also to say that. This is a sort of story that's been brewing for a while. It almost seemed like it would never get here, and yet suddenly here we are. A lot of implications. I think, you know, Disney is clearly very eager to scale up and really take on Netflix and some of the Silicon Valley players. And so what that means is they're going to incorporate as much of these Fox properties as they can. And some of your listeners might know, I mean, this is a wide range of film and movie titles and film and TV production. And, you know, you're talking about, you know, the cable channels like FX and National Geographic. I mean, it really does run the gamut. And so, you know, these are all going to be in Disney's stable. And what it essentially means is that they're going to kind of control you know, really a lot of the content, a lot of the movies and TV shows we see in this country. And apparently they had big plans for them. I mean, that includes, you know, streaming them, that includes selling them in various ways. And so, you know, we're really going to see, much as we've seen Netflix and some of these other companies really be these kind of players in providing us, you know, shows and films directly. You know, this merger finally takes shape as it's doing right now. We're going to see that from Disney as well.
And, you know, I think one conversation that this whole story has really pulled upon and made us really confront is the idea of what we do and do not know and how we interpret regulatory laws.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of murkiness about this. You know, some listeners might know as well, the Comcast bid came in last month because AT&T Time Warner was basically, after being challenged by the government, was basically sort of given a green light by the courts. And so, you know, that kind of, you know, paved the way for Comcast to say, hey, look, if AT&T as a telecom company can do it, maybe we can do it as a cable distributor or cable provider as well. The thing that's gotten some people a little bit sort of confused is that not long after that, Disney released a statement. I think it was Disney. It might have come from the Department of Justice, saying, hey, our merger is fine. You know, Disney and Fox are not problematic, and they can go ahead. And I think, to your point, that raised a lot of eyebrows as far as people saying, hey, wait a second, this thing, we just had a court case that went on for months. Eventually, the companies won, but why is this all being given this sort of fast track? What is it about regulatory law that allows this Disney-Fox merger to go through as quickly, raises questions about the Trump administration? Why were they trying so hard to stop AT&T Time Warner and not this one? So I think it does raise a lot of questions and a lot of murkiness.
Yeah, indeed. I think that beat of the conversation emerges quickly every time this topic comes up. But really, as you point out in the story, which for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and tweet it out after the program so you can read it for yourself. It's very, very interesting. But it really, as you point out in the story, this doesn't change this kind of tug of war between Comcast and Disney as much as it just kind of puts it in a new space.
That's right. That's right. I mean, Disney, Comcast are the, you know, for better or worse, and people can have their opinions about that, but they are the two sort of megaliths here as far as traditional media and entertainment companies. You know, Comcast, of course, being the giant cable provider that in 2009 bought NBC Universal. Disney, you know, always a sort of juggernaut, and obviously been ramping up and doing quite well with the Marvel movies and the Star Wars movies and things of that sort. So they're clearly going to be battling here. The battle particularly is shifting now, as you allude to Sky, which is a European cable giant. I think they're in five countries. They've got, you know, over 20 million subscribers. Comcast really wants them. Comcast really wants to be kind of more of an international player than they are right now. And Disney wants them as well. And they're both fighting for this sort of 60% that's outstanding. Disney, after buying Fox, will already own 40%. But the battle is going to play out, and I would not be surprised if we see other assets. You know, it's hard to imagine Disney ever trying to get bigger, but they keep doing that, and it's easy to conceive that there might be some other assets down the road that Comcast and Disney are fighting over. So we'll see how this plays out.
Right. And so what are the next steps that we need to be watching for? And you know, in particular, I wonder, you note in the story that the Disney bid still needs to be approved by Fox shareholders later this month, barring any curveballs. What might those curveballs be?
Yeah, it's hard to see there being fast, you know, any sliders or real breaking balls here. I mean, you've got, obviously Rupert and the family who, you know, only control a smaller percentage of the stock, but, you know, they really want this. Look, it's possible that, I don't think you're going to get another bidder coming in, but something comes out about Disney. I mean, this is only, we're talking about another week or so, but something comes out about Disney that gives shareholders pause. But it's hard to imagine that shareholders wouldn't approve this. I think we're moving full steam ahead. I think what will be interesting as far as curveballs go beyond that is to see what Netflix and some of the other players do in response. I mean, this was Disney basically throwing down the gauntlet and saying, hey, you guys are investing so much, in content. We're going to kind of, this is our move. This is our acquisition. But look, Apple has been, you know, every week there seems to be a new show being developed by Apple. Apple's very deep-pocketed. We don't know yet what they're going to do as far as putting content out there. So while I think the Disney-Fox merger is a foregone conclusion, at this point, I think there's still a lot yet to be written about how their moves are going to play out relative to the rest of the market.
Right. In particular, I wonder also about, you know, it seems like a really interesting time for smaller production companies doing really interesting work. It seems like the opportunity is much wider than before because because of things like Netflix, and because Netflix and Hulu is, you know, they've been investing in original content. It seems like the opportunity, the doors are just kind of open. And I wonder if that will open them more or if that will narrow that passage of opportunity there.
It's a funny thing, isn't it? I mean, you've got, you know, it's a time of great consolidation on the one hand and great opportunity on the other. And so, you know, I think both these things can be true, even if they seem somewhat contradictory. I mean, you know, you're certainly on the legacy media side, I think all this consolidation is a little bit worrisome in that regard. I mean, you know, look, we've had waves of consolidation before, but there have been, you know, a fairly diverse set of conglomerates even for a while. You know, we're talking about NBC, you know, in the studio and film and movie side, you're talking about companies like NBC Universal, you know, Sony, Warner Brothers, Paramount, obviously all the Disney properties. So to start seeing consolidation there, and Fox, of course, is a little bit concerning. But at the same time, the fact that you do have all of these tech giants getting into content. I talked to a producer source of mine not long ago who was saying, look, you know, if you had told me, you know, even 5 years ago or certainly 10 or more years ago that I could have a very robust career making movies and TV shows and never deal with any of those conglomerates, I would have said you were crazy. And yet here we are now, you know, bidding wars taking place between Netflix and Apple and Amazon over a new show. So there's a lot of opportunity out there, but there's also a lot of consolidation in response to it. So it's a fascinating time.
It really is. Well, we will keep turning to you for the latest as this and other stories continue to unfold. Steven Zajcik, entertainment business writer at Washington Post, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break and get you to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello there. It's Amy Guth, and this is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Up next on the program, we're joined by phone by Emily Badger, a New York Times writer covering urban policy, who wrote about the risks and potential rewards of cities that are attempting to plan for the future of driverless cars. And it really kind of brings up this more philosophical discussion point, really, about how do you plan for a technology that still has a very uncertain future. There's a lot to it. So joining us now, please welcome Emily. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So glad you're with us today. I appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday to talk with us about this. So this is such an interesting story because it really does, as I say, kind of get at this philosophical point about planning for a future when it's still kind of a fraught technology.
Right. I mean, in some ways, this feels like a very theoretical debate, you know, arguing about how are driverless cars going to impact our cities? How are they going to change the behavior of consumers and commuters? You know, are they going to complement public transit? Are they going to replace public transit? But I think what's happening right now is that the thing that feels sort of theoretical is increasingly becoming, you know, very real in that cities are already making decisions about how to build infrastructure and what to plan right now in anticipation of the driverless future. So we have some cities who have decided, we think autonomous cars are going to make trains obsolete. Let's not build trains. Let's not invest in railways. Let's not invest in dedicated bus infrastructure. You know, we have other cities sort of wondering if certain kinds of transit are going to complement autonomous vehicles in the future, and we should sort of double down on those kinds of transit. You know, that would be like the L system in Chicago that, you know, has, with really high capacity, moves lots and lots of people, and it may be necessary for that system to continue to function in the future. So even though this feels like theoretical and hypothetical, you know, cities have to make decisions right now about the future, and so these debates are already playing out right now.
And I think a lot of times when we're talking about new technology, I think we have a tendency, because it's often the case, to really just think of it in terms of, well, that's not for us regular people. That's for very wealthy people. I couldn't touch that anyway, until technology becomes more widely adapted and then it's more widely available to some, but still out of reach for many. So is that kind of wealth inequality conversation part of this here too?
Absolutely, because, you know, we already see some communities across the country who have decided that, you know, maybe a more efficient way to operate our transit system would be to give subsidies to companies like Uber and Lyft and basically ask them to operate it instead. And, you know, that model is not radically different from what many people are predicting in the future, that when we have autonomous vehicles, you know, people won't own them. You know, you will just call a car that's owned by some other company or service and it will come to your house and take you where you need to go. And, you know, potentially this sort of private service blurs these lines with public transportation. But, you know, a lot of people are very nervous about this idea as well because it raises these equity questions. You know, what about people who don't have smartphones? What about people who don't have credit cards? You know, what about people who, you know, need to only pay $1.50 for a ride instead of $10 for a ride? Are we sort of forgetting about all of those people and getting all excited about contracting out to these private companies to provide what's essentially a public utility in transportation? So, you know, you're absolutely right that there are these equity issues that are baked into this debate, but a lot of times they get overlooked because people are more concerned with, you know, the sort of gee whiz shiny object aspect of new technology and how will it transform our communities.
I know. I always say that same thing, too, that the new shiny object syndrome, we turn into cats and we just kind of pounce on those new things. Indeed.
So, yeah, I mean,
go ahead.
Yes, I think that's exactly what's going on here. And part of this debate too is about, you know, when is the new shiny object going to arrive? If you think the new shiny object is going to get here in 5 years, then maybe it makes sense to start sort of retrofitting our world to accommodate it. If you think it's not going to get here for 30 years at any kind of scale that would, you know, be accessible to the general public, then it makes absolutely no sense to, you know, turn on a dime and change everything about what you're doing in order to accommodate them.
Mm-hmm. What cities are kind of leading the way in this conversation?
Well, it depends on how you define leading the way, in the sense that there are sort of two different camps here. I mean, I'm based out in San Francisco, and, you know, there's a lot of thinking in Silicon Valley that says that leading the way is, you know, sort of starting to think beyond transit, think about what comes after transit. You know, let's, instead of building a rail line to the airport, let's dedicate a road of the highway for autonomous vehicles only. You know, if you think that that is leading the way, then, you know, there are some communities like, the San Francisco metropolitan area that are starting to think about things like that. If you believe that leading the way is, you know, doubling down on transit, being sort of skeptical of tech optimism, Seattle is a community that I think is really sort of leaning into that, that has been very clear about the fact that we think that public transit is going to be central to our transportation future tomorrow and 30, 40 years from now, and they are investing very heavily in expanding their public transit. So it's this, in some ways, it's this kind of bipolar debate where people have radically different ideas about what they think is right. So in some ways, your answer to that question depends on your orientation in this argument.
And does this also create tension between, you know, city planners and technologists? Meaning, are people who are kind of at the wheel of cities and transportation conversations, are cities equipped to start having these conversations about this kind of technology?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is tremendous tension between these two groups of people. I mean, there's also sort of overlap. There are folks who have kind of one foot in each camp. But, you know, my experience in talking to sort of traditional transportation planners on one hand and folks in the tech industry who are really sort of rooted in the autonomous car industry is that they, you know, not only do they have radically different ideas, but they're sort of mutually suspicious of each other. You know, so city planners, transportation planners really chafe at the idea that folks in the tech industry who don't have, you know, deep traditional expertise in urban planning are now proposing these sort of radical solutions to something that they don't understand very well. But I also talked to folks in the tech industry who, you know, felt like transportation planners were guilty of this tremendous hubris and that, you know, they want to dictate what the world will look like 30 years from now by, you know, investing heavily in these, you know, fixed infrastructure, rail lines, dedicated bus lanes, that they are effectively sort of saying, you know, we're going to impose our vision of what we think the future is 30 years from now, and we're going to sort of block other potential ideas from coming to fruition. So, you know, there's great sort of tension and also kind of mutual suspicion of each other, which cities are probably going to have to overcome if they're going to resolve these pretty thorny questions in the coming years.
It seems that another narrative that will need to be addressed pretty boldly before real meaningful conversations around autonomous cars can happen. It seems like the predominant, you know, conversation and narrative around them is about safety, because we hear these horrific stories of, you know, these driverless cars like driving right into something and injuring or killing somebody. And I think that kind of just jumps to the head of the line. And so how do technologists, you know, where are they starting with kind of overcoming that? Is that just a matter of improving technology, and then the narrative will address itself, or is it something else?
Well, this comes to another sort of central cleavage between these two groups in that, you know, I think within the tech industry, there's sort of tremendous confidence in the ability of computers and software and algorithms to solve problems and replace human error. And, you know, folks in that camp will frequently point out that, you know, we have about 30,000 fatalities in America per year right now as a result of traffic crashes. And the vast majority of those are caused by human error. You know, they're caused by a driver looking at their phone or a driver being distracted. And, you know, if you sort of think about all of the human error and the high costs of it, you know, from their point of view, computers could do radically better. You know, a computer is not going to look at its iPhone, and an automated car is not going to get distracted by conversation with someone in the backseat. But the sort of counter argument to that, that a lot of transportation and urban planners have made to me, is, you know, technologists are so focused on the technology itself that they don't think enough about how technology interacts with an environment that will be full of humans. So, you know, yes, a computer driving a car may not have human error, but the computer driving car is still going to have to interact with humans on the street. There's still going to be pedestrians and cyclists and, you know, people getting in and out of cars on streets. And I think there's a lot of concern that, you know, that technologists are not thinking enough about the human world that this technology is going to inhabit. And, you know, what happens when, you know, today drivers and pedestrians crossing the street make eye contact, and that's part of how we ensure that we're safe and that we don't collide with each other. A computer can't make eye contact with a passenger. You know, I think there's a lot of concern about how do we think about those kinds of things. Are technologists thinking about those kinds of things, or are they primarily just thinking about, you know, how do we build these things from a technical perspective?
It really is quite an interesting story, and I think, you know, as I said at the top of the segment, it really gets very quickly to a lot of philosophical conversations and questions to ponder. So very, very interesting stuff. Emily Badger, New York Times writer covering urban policy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having the conversation.
You bet. Thanks so much. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and tweet this and the other stories on the program today out after the show. So we're going to take a little break, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. So, if you are an avid social media user, you have probably seen recently there's a lot of conversation going on Twitter and Facebook about plastic straws. And there's a lot of people that say we should ban plastic straws. Here's this single-use piece of plastic. There's other people saying it allows some people to drink where they otherwise could not. A lot of like disability rights activists are having that conversation and entering that debate saying, I hear you with regard to the, you know, recycling issue. However, think about the access it grants a lot of people. So it's a really interesting debate, and I encourage you to read all about it and get into it and consider it and see what you think. But there is a New York Times story that is a very interesting, I don't want to call it a footnote because it's not insignificant, but the headline on it is how a 9-year-old boy's statistic shaped a debate on straws. So, Starbucks, Marriott, they're banning the plastic straws. And so, this data point that a lot of these conversations have had is Americans use about 500 million straws each day. And that's been cited widely. USA Today, CNN, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Fox News, New York Times, all kind of people have cited this one data point. But this number is based on research conducted years ago by a very enterprising 9-year-old Vermont boy named Milo Chris. And so as this detail emerges, it's like, well, does him being 9 change this data? And so there's, a very interesting story. If you follow me on Twitter, I'll be sure and tweet it out. But Griffin, where are you on the, you know, straw issue? And this data point around a 9-year-old boy, does that change any of it for you?
Well, that story was so strange.
And so strange,
They talked to him now today. He's like 17.
Yeah.
And he's just kind of like, I don't know why they're using my stat. I tried, but I was also 9. They explained how he got to that number, too. It was like he called a number of manufacturers and talked to them about what their numbers were like. And then he took an average.
Right.
Which is like
a perfectly acceptable. I mean, I think
a decent amount of rigor for someone who's under the age of 10.
But you under the age of 40. That's great.
Well, you might expect a little more from the people who went on.
Depends on what field you're in, but
yes. To cite it. But so it's just interesting. I think it's indicative of the way some of these conversations unfold, because you kind of start to realize we all are a little bit out of our depth in talking about it. So if you feel strongly that, yes, of course, you must ban straws and take a closer look at the data you're working with. I mean, and then they point out that the number is probably closer to...
like 170.
Somewhere between the 170 and 390, which is a big window. But
huge.
Notable, like, market research firms found those kinds of numbers. And so there's debate on where it falls in there, but it's something like that. Still a big number. And you can still feel like we use too many plastic straws, but you just need to...
yeah, you're
a little more rigorous.
Right. You're still free to think that, hey, even one plastic straw is too many. And I totally hear that on single-use plastic. I've been trying to eliminate plastic in my life. I always, if I order a drink, I always say, no straw, please, because I don't want it.
Yeah.
But I felt that way about it. And I thought, yeah, sure, yeah. Okay, we should move to paper straws. I get that. But then I started having some conversations with some people who are like, you know what? Think about that straws allow drinking access to some people who have different abilities. And that changed my thinking on that a little bit. Like, well, okay, fair enough. If that is a matter of being able to drink something and not drink something, or, you know, to drink something in public or easily or independently without assistance, then it's a very different conversation. So it's a complicated one.
Yeah. And I'm reading from a website called Care2. It's an interesting point. This is another thing kind of on the con side, where you could think any elimination of any plastic is probably better for pollution in general. I'm quoting here, straw bans aren't going to fix our global plastic obsession, and focusing on them to the exclusion of larger issues could be damaging in the long term. The rancor and ill will swirling around the straw discussion certainly isn't producing the most thoughtful conversation about plastic waste. And it's, I kind of agree with that too, especially when it seems to be dictated by things that we're not, again, like quote unquote facts that we're just not 100% on. And I also know that there's a video of a sea turtle, I think, choking on a plastic straw that's really motivated a lot of this discussion, I think, too. And rightfully so. I mean, it's pretty, I haven't watched it, but it's horrifying to think about, and something possibly good that gets people worked up in discussing it. But, you just worry about motivations, and there's so many ways to tackle this gigantic problem. And if you take a way in that is easy to poke holes in for some people, then you do a disservice to the larger cause, I think.
Yeah, totally.
So it's just kind of dicey territory.
Yeah, I agree. And it's, it's interesting. Whenever this one is one of those kind of balance issues, and it's a struggle issue, because on one hand, we got to start somewhere. Do what you can.
Definitely.
I get that. And it bothers me.
That's how
me.
I feel, too.
Yeah.
Immediately, I was like, yeah, sure.
Right.
We could probably do without them.
Same.
Let's give it a try.
And it drives me crazy when people go, don't you have bigger things to worry about? It's like, well, but this is the issue in front of me at this moment. I have a choice. I'm ordering an iced tea, and I have the choice to say no straw, please. I'm saving one little piece of plastic, and if, 10,000 people did that today, that's a little bit of less plastic in the world. Great. So... I get that, but I also think we should not focus all of our attention on like straw plastic at the exclusion of looking at bigger petrochemical things and I think that's where people, just because we're talking about straws at one moment doesn't mean, or someone feels strongly about banning straws, doesn't mean that we should not, we shouldn't focus on that at the exclusion of other, issues around plastic and petrochemical and all that. So. But it's tricky. I hate it when people go, oh, worry about bigger things. Well, I am. But right now, I have to make a decision if I want to straw my iced tea. You know what I mean? It's that. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, I'm going to tweet this story out, too, after the program. So if you follow me on Twitter, I'm at Amy Guth on Twitter. I will be sure and tweet out all the stories link to the Twitter handles of all the folks we talked to today. So you can follow them and you can read their stories for yourself. All right. Well, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.